Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Southeast City Church podcast. My name is David Hood, and I help give pastoral leadership to Southeast City Church. And we are a church plant taking root in Ottawa's Alta Vista neighborhood, and we exist to see our neighborhood in particular, but really our city as a whole, saturated with the love, good news, and hope of Jesus for life transformation and cultural renewal. In an age full of very complex issues, we still believe that Jesus is the answer to all of our questions, the solution to all of our problems, and the satisfaction of all of our deepest longings and desires. What, or rather who, we need more than anything is Jesus. We need to trust Him, give our lives to Him, and follow Him. And that is what our church is all about, helping people discover, know, trust, and follow Jesus. We gather together every Sunday to sing about who Jesus is and what He's done, to hear from Jesus through formative teaching, respond to Jesus through reflection, confession, and prayer, and celebrate Jesus through communion, and just to be together, because none of us can do this alone. We need each other. We also scatter throughout the week into family gatherings in people's homes for mutual learning around Scripture and deep prayer for our church, city, and world, into going deeper groups, which are small, same-gender groups that meet at different times, in different places for vulnerability, encouragement, accountability, and prayer, into discipleship groups for youth and young adults, and into various outreaches to people in our area that are experiencing food insecurity, poverty, trauma, addictions, mental illness, loneliness, and isolation. We long to see God's kingdom come, and His will be done in our city, as it is in heaven. What you are about to listen to is a recording of our teaching from this past Sunday. I hope that wherever you are on your spiritual journey, that this teaching would speak to you and help you. I also hope that you'll go to our website, southeastcitychurch.ca. On our website, you can learn more about our church and listen to past teachings and powerful testimonials from people in our church about how Jesus has made the difference in their lives. If you feel led, you can give to what God is doing through our church in our nation's capital. But most importantly, you can reach out to us through our contact page and request connection and prayer. Somebody will respond. Lastly, we would love to have you join us sometime on a Sunday. We meet every Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Martin Luther Church, 933 Smythe Road, unless otherwise stated on our socials and website. You don't have to believe what we believe or know exactly what you believe to be with us. We welcome questions, the messiness of life, and the journey. There is a place for you at our table. Thanks for listening, and may God bless you.
All right. Our text today is going to be starting at the end of Judges chapter 8 and going through the whole of Judges chapter 9. It is a long passage, so what we're going to do is we're going to break it up. So I'm not going to read it all in one go, but rather we're going to read and have explanation as we go along. The text is up on the screen if you need it, but there's also Bibles at the back. Feel free to take one. Those are our gift to you, regular print and large print. So we are, for those that don't know, in a series right now on what we're calling the strange, dark, violent world of Judges, and it is a strange, dark, violent world, and Matt last week took us through the second part of the story of Gideon's life, and now we're talking about the life of Abimelech. Now, this is a story that might be less known to you. It's not really one of the ones that you think of when you think of Judges. You think of Samson and you think of Gideon, but a lot of people don't think of this story about Abimelech. It's a story of his life, but in many ways, it's also the story of Gideon's legacy, because Abimelech is Gideon's son, and Abimelech carries on a lot of what Gideon did, especially in the latter part of his life. If you were here last week, you remember that Matt shared that while Gideon started really well, he didn't end very well. He ended his life enjoying power and privilege and comfort and wealth and pleasure. He had accumulated a lot of wealth through his revenge missions, through his plundering. Everyone wanted him to lead, so he enjoyed power, and he also enjoyed a significant amount of pleasure. He had, it says, Judges 8:30, Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, since he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Then Gideon, son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abizrites. And when Gideon died, the Israelites turned and prostituted themselves with the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god. And the Israelites did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the power of the enemies around them. They did not show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, for all the good that he had done for Israel. So Gideon ends his life. He had gone on these revenge missions, lots of violence, lots of ego, lots of pride. And he ends his life not the timid, fearful person hiding in a wine press to thresh his grain, but he ends his life with this power and this wealth and living for pleasure. And it says that he had 70 sons by different wives, and while the judges and their offspring didn't exercise kingship in the ways that the kings of Israel will later, they obviously exercised de facto power. The judges and their kids exercised de facto power. They were looked to for political leadership, and they were treated as kings by the city states. And one of those many sons of Gideon is Abimelech, who was a son of Gideon by his concubine, mistress, in Shechem. Abimelech wanted all that his father had. All the power, all the privilege, all the comfort, all the wealth, all the pleasure. He wanted all that his father had for himself. He didn't want to share it alongside his 70 half-brothers. And so in chapter 9 and verse 1, it says, Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal, went to his mother's brothers at Shechem and spoke to them and to all his maternal grandfather's clan. Now, what you need to know about Shechem was that it was a powerful Canaanite and Israelite city-state near the border between the tribal territories of Manasseh and Ephraim. It held significant influence and sway over the nation as a whole. It was a powerful city. If you wanted to be king, if you wanted to be elevated to status, you needed the support of Shechem. Shechem had a very rich history. Abraham built an altar to Yahweh at Shechem when he first arrived in Canaan before the fulfillment of the land promise. And ironically, Shechem was where Joshua gave his now famous speech, "Choose this day whom you will serve." Right, then he stood in front of the people and he said, are you going to serve Yahweh or are you going to serve the gods of your ancestors? Are you going to serve the true God of heaven and earth? Or are you going to serve these false gods that can't hear, can't see, can't save, can't help? And all the people said, we will only ever serve Yahweh all the days of our life. And now there's altars to Baal at Shechem. So Shechem has this rich history. It's an important city. So Abimelech, being from there, his family being from there, he goes there, starts with his family. Verse 2, please speak in the presence of all the lords, that is the influential nobles and elites of Shechem. Even back then, nobles and elites, having all the power, having all the say. Go to them. Is it better for you that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and blood. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words about him in the presence of all the lords of Shechem. And they were favorable to Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. So they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith. And Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men with this money, and they followed him. And he went to his father's house in Ophrah and killed his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, on top of a large stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, survived because he hid himself. Then all the lords of Shechem and of Beth Millo gathered together and proceeded to make Abimelech king at the oak of the pillar in Shechem. Not that I've watched this show, but I know about this show. This is Game of Thrones type stuff, right? He gets the full support of his mother's side of the family and the lords of Shechem, and he stages a coup of sorts against his father's side of the family, his father's whole side of the family. He hires worthless and reckless men. I love that description. These are men with no moral scruples. They're just going along with whatever it is Abimelech wants to do. He hires them with cult money, so that's money from Baal's temple treasury, and they march up to Ophrah, and he rounds up and brutally executes 69 of his brothers, it says, on one stone. As Daniel Block observes, all of Gideon's sons could have been killed on one stone only by murdering them serially, one after the other. This was a calculated, brutal act of murder, not a quick slaughter of unsuspecting victims. These people are not killed in the night, killed in their homes, killed separately on different days, in different places. They are all rounded up, all brought to the same place, and one by one, Abimelech kills them. Imagine being at the end of that line, knowing what's coming. Abimelech's rule was forged from the very beginning in betrayal and violence and a lust for power. Only one brother survives, Jotham, the youngest, by hiding. However, he doesn't go quietly into the night. Verse 7, when they told Jotham, he climbed to the top of Mount Gerizim, raised his voice and called to them, "Listen to me, lords of Shechem, and may God listen to you. The trees set out to anoint a king over themselves. They said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Should I stop giving my oil that honors both God and man and rule over the trees?' Then the trees said to the fig tree, 'Come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Should I stop giving my sweetness and my good fruit and rule over trees?' Later the trees said to the grapevine, 'Come and reign over us.' But the grapevine said to them, 'Should I stop giving my wine that cheers both God and man and rule over trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, 'Come and reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If you really are anointing me as king over you, come and find refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon.' Now, if you have acted faithfully and honestly in making Abimelech king, if you have done well by Jerubbaal and his family, and if you have rewarded him appropriately for what he did, for my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you from the hand of Midian, and now you have attacked my father's house today, killed his 70 sons on top of a large stone, and made Abimelech the son of his slave king over the lords of Shechem because he is your brother. If then you have acted faithfully and honestly with Jerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and may he also rejoice in you. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech and consume the lords of Shechem and Beth Millo. And may fire come from the lords of Shechem and Beth Millo and consume Abimelech.' Then Jotham fled, escaping to Beer, and lived there because of his brother Abimelech." Essentially, Jotham curses the nation. He curses specifically Abimelech and the people who allied themselves with Abimelech and engaged in his violent acts. And the curse is that fire is going to come out from Abimelech against the people of Shechem, and fire is going to come out of the people of Shechem against Abimelech. They are going to be each other's undoing. Abimelech's going to harm them. They're going to harm Abimelech. They're going to all take each other down. The end of them is going to be by their own hands. And then in verse 22, it says, when Abimelech had ruled over Israel 3 years. We jump ahead quite suddenly, quite a bit. There's literally nothing about Abimelech's rule. We read about his rise, we read about his fall, but there's very little of what's in between. We don't know what his rule was like. But interestingly, this says something about the narrator. We don't, again, know who wrote Judges, but this says something about the narrator's view. For Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years, the narrator uses a word that comes from the Hebrew for captain or high official. He acknowledges Abimelech as somebody influential and powerful, but he will not call him a king. For the narrator, Abimelech is not any kind of king, and certainly not a king of Israel, and God doesn't recognize him as king either. And it's at this point in the story that God intervenes to disrupt Abimelech's rule, and the narrator is not ambiguous as to why. God is judging Abimelech and his allies for fratricide. It says in verse 23, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the lords of Shechem, and they treated Abimelech deceitfully, so that the crime against the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come to justice, and their blood would be avenged on their brother Abimelech, who killed them, and on the lords of Shechem, who had helped him kill his brothers. The lords of Shechem rebelled against him by putting people on the tops of the mountains to ambush and rob everyone who passed by them on the road. This was reported to Abimelech. So a spirit is sent that starts to sow division and discord between Abimelech and the lords of Shechem. And we'll get back to what that means near the end. But at this point in the story, the lords are starting to become displeased with Abimelech. Maybe he looked at them wrong. Maybe he didn't invite them to something that they felt they should have been invited to. Maybe he didn't ask their opinion, didn't show them the proper respect for people of their status and standing and position. Maybe he made a decision that they didn't like, but they are starting to not like Abimelech anymore. They're displeased with him. And they start to actively sabotage his rule. They pay thieves to lie in wait and rob every person coming and going from Shechem. Now, obviously, this is going to hurt Abimelech economically, but it also causes the people of Shechem, where Abimelech has most of his power, it causes them to wonder whether Abimelech is actually that good of a leader. They're wondering if he can actually keep them safe. Where, Abimelech, is the security and the prosperity that you promised us? We're afraid to go out our doors. We can't leave our city. We can't go out to the fields. Our chains, our supply chains have been disrupted. We can't do business. We can't feed our families. Everyone is starting to become unhappy, probably grumbling to the lords of Shechem, who are just like, I know, I don't get it. I don't get why this guy can't lead properly. It is a mystery. And then Gaul comes to town. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but he's got a lot of gall, so we'll call him Gaul. Verse 26, Gaul, son of Ebed, came with his brothers and crossed into Shechem. And the lords of Shechem trusted him. So they went out to the countryside and harvested grains from their vineyards. They trampled the grapes and held a celebration. Then they went to the house of their god, and as they ate and drank, they cursed Abimelech. Gaal, son of Ebed, said, Who is Abimelech, and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Isn't he the son of Jerubbaal, and isn't Zebul his officer? If you are to serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, why should we serve Abimelech? If only these people were in my power, I would remove Abimelech. So he said to Abimelech, Gather your army and come out. And we don't know anything about this Gaal. There's so many details that I'm like, why did you not put that in there? But we don't know anything about him. He just sort of suddenly appears on the scene, and he's a challenger to Abimelech's power. It is likely that he is a native of Shechem himself, a Shechemite, and he may even be a descendant of Hamor, who he says here is the founder of the city. Daniel Block, in his commentary, observes that Gaal may have been one of the lords of Shechem himself. But unlike the rest of his aristocratic peers, he and his clan refused to support Abimelech's purge and were forced to flee into exile, from where they waited patiently for an opportunity to return. Compelled by the hidden hand of God, he and his clansmen returned to Shechem, and immediately the lords of Shechem accept him as their champion. This is the guy who can help us bring down Abimelech. We don't really care who he is. We don't really care what he's about. This is the guy that can help us. And so in a night of drunken debauchery and idolatry at the local temple, he turns the whole mood of the city against Abimelech. And he wins the support of the lords, who are already displeased with Abimelech. And in a drunken stupor, to everyone who's cheering him on, he declares war on Abimelech. Verse 30, when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, son of Ebed, he was angry. So he sent messengers secretly to Abimelech, saying, Look, Gaal, son of Ebed, it really matters that he's the son of Ebed, I guess, with his brothers have come to Shechem and are turning the city against you. Now tonight, you and the people with you are to come, wait in ambush in the countryside. Then get up early and at sunrise charge the city when he and the people who are with him come out against you. Do to him whatever you can. So Abimelech and all the people with him got up at night and waited in ambush for Shechem and four units. Obviously, Abimelech is not home at Shechem at this point. He's somewhere else. He's out of town. And so Zebul, who's the commander of the city and obviously very sympathetic to Abimelech, reports all of this to him and advises him, when you come back, set up an ambush outside the city. The city's turning on you. So set up an ambush, and when people come out, attack. Attack the city. And Abimelech does. Verse 35. Gaal, son of Ebed, went out and stood at the entrance of the city gate. Then Abimelech and the people who were with him got up from their ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops." But Zebul said to him, "The shadows of the mountains look like men to you." Then Gaal spoke again, "Look, people are coming down from the central part of the land, and one unit is coming up from the direction of the diviner's oak." And Zebul replied, "Where is your mouthing off now? You said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Aren't these the people you despised? Now go up and fight them.'" So Gaal went out, leading the lords of Shechem, and fought against Abimelech. But Abimelech pursued him, and Gaal fled before him. Many wounded died as far as the entrance of the gate. Abimelech stayed in Arumah, and Zebul drove Gaal and his brothers from Shechem. So Gaal and the lords of Shechem are soundly, and it would seem, quickly and easily defeated. And this should be the end of the story. This should be where it wraps up. Abimelech lived happy for the rest of his days. But in verse 42, it says this: "The next day when the people went into the countryside, this was reported to Abimelech. And he took the people, divided them into three companies, and waited in ambush in the countryside. He looked, and the people were coming out of the city. So he arose against them and struck them down. Then Abimelech and the units that were with him rushed forward and took their stand at the entrance of the city gate. The other two units rushed against all who were in the countryside and struck them down. So Abimelech fought against the city that entire day, captured it, killed the people who were in it. Then he tore the city down and sowed it with salt. When all the lords of the tower of Shechem," so not the lords of Shechem, but the guardians of the temple, "heard, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El Berith. Then it was reported to Abimelech that all the lords of the tower of Shechem had gathered together. So Abimelech and all the people who were with him went up to Mount Zalmon. And Abimelech took his axe in his hand and cut a branch from the trees. He picked up the branch, put it on his shoulder, and said to the people who were with him, 'Hurry and do what you have seen me do.' Each person also cut down his own branch and followed Abimelech. They put the branches against the inner chamber and set it on fire around the people, and all the people in the tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women." With Gaal and the lords defeated, the ordinary citizens of Shechem breathe a sigh of relief. Finally, things can get back to normal. I'm not really sure what that was, but it's over with. We can get back to our regular lives. They're trying to get on with their lives, but Abimelech decides that it's not enough for him, that he defeated Gaal and he defeated the lords. The whole city of Shechem now needs to feel his wrath. He's got to punish absolutely everybody. And so he attacks not random people, but his very own people, his citizens, his subjects. He attacks them in the fields while they're doing their everyday work. And then he attacks the lower city itself, killing everyone, tearing down the walls, burning their homes and businesses to the ground, and then covering it with salt, which may have been a ritualistic act that invoked some kind of irrevocable curse on the site. It may also have been to render the land infertile so that the city could never be rebuilt. He then moves on to the upper part of the city, where the citadel and the temple fortress are. Everyone remaining has fled there, and everyone is hiding in the inner rooms from their own king, terrified of his wrath and fury. And seeing that they are all there in one place, he loads up the base with wood, builds a bonfire, burns it, sets it ablaze, and kills, it says, all 1,000 men, women, and children inside. And Abimelech at this point is still not satisfied. And he decides he's going to punish all the nearby towns as well. He's on an ever-expanding revenge quest, high on his monumental victory at Shechem. And it's unclear, really, what's going to satisfy him. Like, at what point is he going to have had enough revenge? We don't know. And so he goes. It says in verse 50, Abimelech went to Thebez, camped against it, and captured it. And there was a strong tower inside the city, and all the men, women, and lords of the city fled there. They locked themselves in and went up to the roof of the tower. And when Abimelech came to attack the tower, he approached its entrance to set it on fire. This is Shechem all over again. He attacks the town. Everybody runs to the fortified tower. They all go up to the roof. He's like, I burned the tower at Shechem. I'm going to burn this tower too. Everybody is going to burn alive again until the world knows that Abimelech has value, until the world knows that Abimelech matters and is significant and shouldn't be trifled with. He's got a massive, massive ego, and he feels like he can just keep doing this over and over and over again everywhere he goes, and so he gets ready to set ablaze this tower. And then it says in verse 53, but a woman threw the upper portion of a millstone on Abimelech's head and fractured his skull. And he quickly called his armor bearer and said to him, draw your sword and kill me, or they'll say about me, a woman killed him. So his armor bearer thrust him through and he died. I just want to say two things here. First of all, can we acknowledge how boss the women of Judges are? Like, over and over and over again, we've seen some absolutely boss women. Like Deborah, the warrior prophetess, Jael, saying to, Sisera, come into my tent, here's a blanket, here's some warm milk, you've had a hard day, you fought hard, have a nap, oh thank you, I feel so safe and warm, and I'm going to hammer a tent peg through your head into the ground. Brains everywhere. And now this woman, Abimelech's attacking the tower. Here's a millstone on your head, fracturing your skull. Boss women. Like, let's just acknowledge it. Boss women in the book of Judges. Second, I love how unspectacular Abimelech's end is. This is not a spectacular finish for him. The man who savagely executed 69 of his brothers and killed the lords of the powerful city-state of Shechem, slaughtered all of its people, raised it to the ground, is killed at the end by some random, unnamed civilian woman who drops a part of a stone for grinding wheat on his head. It's not an overly spectacular finish. He was on a mission to avenge his massive ego, and this is how he goes out. And he has to ask his right-hand man to stab him and spare him the shame and disgrace of having been killed as a warrior in the heat of battle by a woman. And yet, as I was reading this, isn't that how historically so many tyrants have gone out? They wreak havoc for years and years and years, but their end, their finish, is oftentimes unspectacular. Committing suicide in silence in a bunker, being found in a sewer pipe and shot, or being found disheveled, having not bathed for months in a hole in the ground, hiding from your enemies, begging for your life and for mercy. So often these people that cause so much pain and violence don't have a spectacular finish. And when it comes to the end for them, they are as weak and as cowardly as anybody else. In verse 55, when the Israelites saw that Abimelech was dead, they all went home. That's it. Okay, that's over. In this way, God turned back on Abimelech the evil that he had done against his father by killing his 70 brothers. And God also returned all the evil of the men of Shechem on their heads. So the curse of Jotham, son of Jerubbaal, came on them. And this concludes the story of Abimelech, and by extension, the story of Gideon is over as well. What do we learn from this? Don't become a dictator. That's it. No, I'm joking. What do we have to learn for our everyday lives from this gruesome story? There's three things, as there so often are. But the first thing that I want us to get out of this story is that your stuff, if left undealt with, outlives you. Your stuff, if left undealt with, outlives you. It gets passed down to your kids. Make no mistake, we are products of the people that have come before us. And if we're parents, our children will be products of us. Abimelech inherited his father's ego and pride and violent, vengeful spirit. And it had devastating consequences for Israel. Right? That was Gideon at the end, just killing all these people in all these towns because they didn't treat him with enough respect. They didn't treat him the way that he felt that he deserved to be treated. And so he just burned their homes and killed them. Like, that was the kind of guy he was by the end. This massive ego, this penchant for violence and vengeance, and all of that was passed down to Abimelech. The reality is that our stuff, if we don't deal with it, it moves on. It doesn't stay with us. It doesn't go into the ground with us. It carries on for generations and generations until it's dealt with. We call this generational sin. It's almost like sin can become embedded at a genetic level. And I think we all know this, right? Like, we know when you see people who wrestle with alcoholism, chances are very good there's alcoholism in their family. And people commit adultery, chances are very good that there is philandering and promiscuity and adultery in their family line. When people have anger issues, they're just full of wrath, they have no self-control, hot temper, chances are pretty good their parents had a hot temper. Their grandparents had a hot temper. It goes back generations, generations, and generations. We become like our parents in good ways and bad. Make no mistake, this is for the parents in the room, make no mistake, like, our kids are going to pick up our stuff. If we're not aware of our stuff, if we're not acknowledging our stuff, if we're not talking about our stuff, if we're not repenting of our stuff, if we are not praying for better for our kids and their kids, it's going to carry on. We're going to send down our anger. We're going to send down our negativity, our sarcasm, our insecurity, our fear, our people-pleasing, our gossip, our passive-aggressiveness. Like, it's going to keep going and keep enslaving our families unless something is done about it. Gideon didn't deal with this stuff. Abimelech picked it up. Devastating consequences for Israel. You see it with David. You see it with all the patriarchs in Genesis. Like, this happens over and over and over again. At some point, it has to stop. So your stuff, if left undealt with, outlives you. That's number one. The second thing I want us to see in this story is that God will deal with evil. God will deal with evil. Now, God does not always act immediately, And that might make us think that he's not going to act at all, but he will. Abimelech was allowed to rise to power. Abimelech was given 3 years of rule, but then his violent end and the violent end of the Lord's was orchestrated by God. God eventually brought him down. In this case, God did it through demonic influence and human machinations, because human beings are naturally petty, jealous, insecure, fearful, and paranoid schemers. We are naturally that way, all right? Especially when wealthy and in positions of power. Now, many have wrestled with the statement in verse 23, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the lords of Shechem. People have wrestled with that. For some, evil spirit is a confusing translation. It doesn't mean God sent a demonic spirit, but it actually means that God sent misfortune or calamity or unpropitious conditions upon Abimelech that caused his allies to start doubting his ability to rule and keep order, which set in motion a chain of events that led to his downfall. That is certainly a possibility and has credible scholarship behind it. But I would say that the idea of God utilizing the demonic is not actually a strange idea in Scripture. We see it in Job. We see it even in the death of Jesus. Only God is God. And even the devil and demons are subject to him. If God says no, they can't do otherwise. If God sets up parameters and boundaries, they can't go beyond them. Like, at the end of the day, even these evil beings, while powerful, they cannot do what God will not allow them to do. In this story, it isn't that God commissioned or directed the demon. He certainly didn't coerce, manipulate, threaten, entice or bribe the demon to do something that it otherwise would not have done. It's not like the demon was wanting to reform his ways. I'm going to do good from now on. And God's like, no, I want you to do some evil over here. It didn't happen like that. Rather, God, for his own good and righteous purposes and ends, permitted the devil to do in this situation what he does best: sow discord and wreak havoc, amplifying towards violent ends what was already present in the hearts of Abimelech and the lords, so that there would be justice for the things that they had done. Regardless of what exactly it means, the point is God acted against Abimelech and the lords of Shechem to judge. God will deal with evil. I love what Psalm 94 says, Lord God of vengeance, God of vengeance, appear. Rise up, judge of the earth. Repay the proud what they deserve. Lord, how long will the wicked, how long will the wicked gloat? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers boast. Lord, they crush your people. They afflict your heritage. They kill the widow and the foreigner and murder the fatherless. They say the Lord doesn't see it. The God of Jacob doesn't pay attention. But can the one who shaped the ear not hear? The one who formed the eye not see? The one who instructs nations, the one who teaches man knowledge, does he not discipline? He will pay them back for their sins and destroy them for their evil. The Lord our God will destroy them. God judges evil. And we might think that's great, because there's a lot of evil happening in the world. There's a lot of injustice all over the place. I hope that all of that gets dealt with. But here's the thing. Because God is holy, that is, he is absolutely morally perfect and pure, he has to deal with all evil. Not just grotesque acts of violence, but our everyday selfishness and greed and pettiness and anger and indifference towards the plight of our neighbors, all the big and little things we do to hurt each other. If God is holy, he's got to judge all of it, everything, small and large, that perpetuates the brokenness of the world, that perpetuates the fall. He has to deal with it, and he will deal with it. Make no mistake, just because judgment is not happening now does not mean that there is not a judgment coming. He's a holy God. So, our stuff, if left undealt with, outlives us, goes down generations. God will deal with evil. The last thing, we are the problem. The reason that the world is the way it is because of us. We are the problem. You will notice in this story that, unlike all of the stories that have preceded it, the enemy of Israel is not some outsider nation. The enemy of Israel in this story is herself. There's no outside nation oppressing Israel. There's no Amalekites, no Midianites, no Kedemites, no Amorites. The oppressor is a son of Gideon, a son of a judge, a fellow Israelite. And what this shows us, we might at this point in the book of Judges think that the problem is the surrounding nations. And as long as Israel didn't have all these other nations to deal with, everything would be pristine. Everything would be perfect, right? We might think, if people around me were just better, then I would be better. If the environment that I lived in was better, then I would be better, right? And what this story shows us is that even if Israel had finally and utterly vanquished from the land every Canaanite nation and rendered them completely incapable of ever returning or exerting influence again, and Israel, they were the only inhabitants in the land, there still would have been oppression and exploitation and theft and violence and war, because there were people there. The Israelites are people like everybody else. The issue wasn't exclusively the surrounding nations. It was and it is the human heart. It's true, what Alexander Solzhenitsyn says. He says, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. Jesus says it this way in Mark 7, what comes out of a person, that defiles him. For from within, out of people's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immoralities, thefts, murders, adulteries, greed, evil actions, deceit, promiscuity, stinginess, blasphemy, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a person. In other words, all the stuff that we do, it isn't out of character. I don't know where that came from. All of the stuff that we do, it was there inside us all along. All of our selfishness, it's there. All of our greed, it's there. All of our lust, it's there. It doesn't just happen because of things around us. It was always there. Our hearts are fundamentally broken, and we need desperately to be touched and transformed by the love of God. We need God to pour his forever love into our hearts, soften our hard hearts, make our hearts new. We need the love of God. And so if I am fundamentally broken and there's nothing I can do about it, and God is going to judge all evil, and my stuff is going to pass down to my kids for generations and generations, like, this is kind of a bleak picture, isn't it? And it is, except for Jesus. Jesus came to fix all of this. Jesus came to take the judgment that we deserve in our place. When he died on the cross, he was taking the judgment that we deserve for our evil in our place as our substitute, so that it wouldn't fall on us if we trusted in him and believed in him. But here's the thing, we often love that part, but that's an incomplete thought. Yes, Jesus took our judgment away, but not just to take our judgment away, not just to deliver us from the judgment that we deserve, but so that we might be delivered to God. There's this justice issue that needs to be solved, and Jesus solved that so that we could be reconciled to God, reconnected to God, so that we could enter into His forever love, so that His love could enter into our lives and fill us up and touch our hearts and soften and change our hearts, and so that we could change and therefore have the things that have been passed down to us that are negative and bad end with us. End with our generation, and things be different for our kids and their kids and the kids after them. Jesus deals with justice. Jesus deals with our heart, and Jesus deals with generational sin. He reconciles us to God so that we can be changed, so that our families can be changed, so that the world around us can be changed. And not temporary peace, like you see in the book of Judges, but real, lasting, deep, eternal change. And this is why Jesus is the better judge. Not a judge who just defeats an outside nation and gives the land a few decades of peace, but a judge who actually deals with the real enemy, our own hearts, and changes things forever. He's the better judge, and he's also the better king. Not a king who is volatile and unpredictable, who if we don't give him enough respect, he lashes out and harms us and those around us until his vengeance is satisfied. No, he is a kind, loving, good king who is for us, for our thriving and flourishing, and sacrifices his life so that we can be changed and enter into the forever love of God. Jesus is the better judge and king. We're going to take some time to respond to all of this. And I have a couple of questions for you to reflect on. And the first one is, what has been passed down to you that needs to end with your generation? What has been passed down to you that needs to end with your generation? The things that you know are harming you and the people around you, that have been harming your family for generations, but nobody talks about it. Nobody deals with it. This is just the way it is. It's the way it's always been. Nothing can change. Well, actually, it can. By Jesus' grace and power, it can. So what's been passed down that needs to end with you? And then the second question, where does God's love still need to touch your heart? Where do you need God's love to change you still? Maybe there's fear. Maybe there's insecurity. Maybe there's lust. Maybe there's pride. Maybe there's self-reliance, people-pleasing. I don't know what it is. God knows what it is. Ask Him what it is. And ask Him to touch your heart that you might be changed for the better. So take some time to reflect on these questions, and when you're ready, if you're a follower of Jesus, come forward and take communion. You can take some bread, dip it in the juice or the prepackaged elements, go back to your seat, take it on your own, or take it with people around you. And today I want you to thank and praise Jesus, that He isn't a flawed deliverer, and that He isn't a volatile, selfish, vengeful king. He's a good king and a good judge who can actually save you, is saving you, will save you, has saved you. Thank Him and praise Him for that. And if you want any prayer for anything, I'm going to be at the back. Come and talk to me. I'd love to pray with you. So we're going to take a few moments, do whatever you feel you need to, you and God, and then Aaron will lead us in our last song together. Let's respond.